Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and your host for today. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. Now, here are some of our upcoming Grown-Ups Forum events. On Friday, October 21st at noon, here, Barbara Rose Brooker will be speaking about the Age March in San Francisco. Barbara Brooker established this Age March some years ago, and she's on a journey to dispel ageism. She believes, as many of us do, that age is not a good metric for what a person has to offer. And so Barbara Rose Brooker will talk about the Age March, and I think the next Age March will be here in San Francisco December 4th on Union Street, and you'll hear more about that. Now, Wednesday, November 2nd, attorney David G. Nitter will speak on how to protect yourself or elder family members from becoming the victim of financial elder abuse, and how to determine whether such abuse may be occurring. These are just two of the many upcoming programs, and I invite you to check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now I'll begin today's program. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to listen to us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Stephen R. Campbell is an award-winning author, speaker, and mentor to individuals and organizations. Known as the Brain Whisperer, he teaches how your mind can be your greatest adversary, and when understood, can be transformed into your greatest friend and ally. After working in hospital administration for 20 years, Stephen acquired his master's degree in information systems and went on to pursue his greatest love, teaching, where he served as a college professor and eventually educational dean for another 20 years. Stephen uses his 20 years of research and university teaching to present easy-to-understand principles that may be applied immediately to improve the quality of our thoughts and lives, while teaching us about how to access the true power of our minds. He also shares the latest research about how the brain learns and how much of our behavior is based not on the truth, but rather on the truth as we perceive it. So let's join together in welcoming Stephen Campbell. Hold it like that.
Okay. Good. You excited? This is going to be, I'm so excited. The Commonwealth Club of San Francisco? Oh, my gosh. Oh, gosh, where do I start? Okay, let's start with this, because I've been thinking about this. Right now, while I am talking to you, you are talking to yourself thousands of times faster. Now, your brain can do that, because when I talk to you, I use words. And when you talk to yourself, you also use words. But when you talk to yourself, you also use pictures and feelings. So when I talk to myself about Mary, my wife, I don't think of her with words. I think of how I feel about her and how pretty she's become to me in the 45 years we've been married. So it would take thousands of words, weeks, for me to explain to you how, what our love has become. So when you're talking to yourself, you really are talking to yourself 1,000 times faster than I'm talking to you right now, which is about 250 to 300 words per minute. But here's the important point, and I'll give it to you right now. Okay, here's my current spot. So look at me. This is really important, okay? In fact, this is the message I'm going to give you. I'm just giving one sentence. While you are talking to yourself, your brain is believing everything you tell it without question. Ew. So when you say, I just cannot do this, do you know what your brain says? Okay. But then it makes sure you can't. That's the scary part. Here's the wonderful part. When you see, I can do this, what does the brain say to that? Okay. Now, is it true? Your brain doesn't even care. And when I heard that in a psychology class years ago, I was really skeptical. And I think one of the best books that I've ever read on this subject is Phantoms in the Brain, written by Dr. V.S. Ramachandran out of UC San Diego. And what Dr. Ramachandran talks about when he talks about phantoms is that a patient may go into a doctor's office. He'll say, you got to help me with my arm. I can't do a thing with it. It's driving me crazy. And the doctor may have to say, well, that could be because I amputated their arm 6 months ago. And the patient says, you didn't tell my brain that. My brain still thinks it's there. My brain feels things with it, and it gets the itchy and achy and cramps up. So the brain doesn't care whether what you're saying is true or not. All the brain cares about is what you tell it. Now, let's go deeper. This is Dr. Albert Ellis. And again, if you give me your business card afterwards, I'll send this to you through email, the slides and the words, so that way you can just sit back and relax. This is one of the founders of cognitive psychology in his book called The Guide to Rational Living. And what Dr. Ellis suggested in his book is that most of what we do is based, or most of what we do is based on what we say to ourselves about ourselves today. Let me say that again. Most of what we can do today is based on what we say to ourselves about ourselves today. Now, when this came out in the early 60s, psychology had a conniption fit, okay? First of all, Freud said, no, the way you are today is because of unresolved childhood conflicts. That's the way you are, okay? That was followed by behaviorism. Remember Dr. Skinner, Harvard University? He said, no, the way you are today is because of cause and effect. That was followed by, it's all in your genes. That didn't last too long. That was followed by environmentalism. The way you are today is because of your environment, your birth order, your mom, your dad, your culture, etc. Dr. Ellis came back and he said, you know what? They're all true. How could they all be true? Because when you say it, your brain literally makes it true. So let me give you an example. For the first 42 years of my life, I said to myself, I'm really stupid in math. And guess what? I was really stupid in math. And I won't go into the details. It's all in my book there. But I was convinced, and I just couldn't do numbers, but I discovered I'm really good with computers and computer software. So I got my graduate degree in computer software from USF and began teaching computer classes. And one day, the dean came to my office. He said, one of our math professors just quit, so you are our new math professor. I can't do numbers. You want a job? Learn. There's the book. Now, this is back in the 80s, so this is way before the internet. So I ran down to the library. I picked up all the books I could on brain-based learning. That's how this whole thing began. And I began teaching. I'll share with you that part in a second. I began teaching my classes based on how the brain learns, which you'll see in a second. And students began saying, oh, you're such a good math teacher. You really are. And then the dean said, you're causing a problem. All the students are saying, I will only take math if Mr. Campbell teaches it. And I said, wait a minute. If I'm so smart with computers, I got to be smart with math. And what did my brain say? Okay. Was it true? Don't care. All I care is what you tell me. And I locked onto that message. You know what my brain did? It rewired itself, called neuroplasticity. Eric Kandel, 2002. In Search of Memory, Nobel Prize. What the brain does is the brain rewires itself to conform to the images and the messages that you're giving it. Isn't that exciting? Can you see where we're going? Boy, wait till we get there. It's going to get really exciting. Ooh, okay, now, so me and math didn't work. In fact, I ended up writing two college textbooks on, what do you think? Math. Isn't that amazing? And it started with my switching what I was saying to myself. That's the message. Now, before we get into what you can do, This is neuroplasticity. Let's talk about how much you can really grow. So this is our daughter, Sarah. This is our younger daughter. This is her brain without the labels, okay? This is what her brain looked like about 30 years ago as she was being raised in Rohnert Park. How many have ever been to Rohnert Park? This is what she knew about a city. Nothing, okay? Blank slate. The closest thing to a city in Rohnert Park is the Ray Lee Shopping Center. So Mary said to me, is an educator, you got to teach her about the city. So I read her a book, because that's what I do. I'm kind of an academic. I read her a book about the city, and the brain recorded the book in the prefrontal cortex right here, just under your forehead, okay? And it recorded as what is called a neural cluster. I'll show you a picture of one in a second. A cluster, little teeny-weeny cluster of neurons. I read her another book. The brain recorded that. Then we introduced her to some friends in San Francisco and Oakland, and then we showed her some buildings and some streets and some parks and some lights and some cars. And then what happened was, and this is what happens, is when she went to sleep that night, her brain first of all says, "Ah, great, leave me alone for the next 8 hours, because now I have to make sense out of all the stuff that you gave me." So it looks at all the stuff that she learned, and it looks for relationships. And it doesn't find one. It creates one. So here's a book about a city. Here's a book about a city. They both got parts and lights and cars. There was no connection, so it created one. Axons, dendrites, synaptic clefts, dopamine, etc. It created connection. It found another connection, so there's another one. And now what you're watching is you're watching Sarah learn. This is what your brain does at night. When you're asleep, we now know that your brain is more active when you're asleep than when you're awake. It's making sense and is creating patterns. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's making patterns, okay? And it's very, very busy. And over time, what happens is it develops what is called a pattern of a city. And now Sarah will never forget what a city is. She'll know the city's got people and lights and cars, etc. Okay? This is called long-term memory. I went to my 50-year high school reunion. I looked at Mary and I said, "Oh my gosh, there's Mickey." And I ran down the court, and Ross ran across the basketball court, and he ran down. We had not seen each other for 50 years. Okay? He had gained about 80 pounds, and I had lost all my hair. But we instantly recognized each other from across the gym among hundreds of people. How did the brain do that? Because 50 years before, and you've been there, it looks like, 50 years before, he recorded a pattern called Steve. I recorded a pattern called Mickey. Okay? That's how we learn. Now, here's when it gets exciting. How many patterns can your brain carry? Bingo, and I'm going to show you. I love you already. I'm going to show you, okay? The patterns are based on the connections. And so if we determine how many connections the human brain will carry, that will give you an idea of how much you can still learn and grow, okay? The connections are based on the number of neurons that you have. So the latest study I've seen, the brain's got about 100 billion neurons, okay? That's white tissue, not gray tissue, okay? Each of those neurons are connected to an average of 10,000 other neurons. Now, that's not a multiple. That's a power. So the number of connections that your brain can carry is 100 billion to the power of 10,000. Know what that is? That's a big number, okay? That's 100 billion times 100 billion. Yeah. Peter Ankins, one of Russia's top neuroscientists, he was a student of Ivan Pavlov. Remember Pavlov? Yeah, okay, he was his student. And back in the early 70s, this is before computers, before the IBM PCs, he wanted to figure out how do you write that number out in longhand. Now, back then, the literature said, and I've already read the literature, that there were about 30 billion brain cells. So how do you write 30 billion to the power of 10,000? So he used a computer, and he calculated that you use about a 12-point font, which is a little bit larger than a newspaper. You start with the number 1, and you follow it by 6.5 million miles of zeros. It's a big number, okay? Here's a picture of prefrontal cortex tissue. Can you see the clusters? Can you see them there? That might be a book. That might be lights. That might be skyscrapers. There's the connections. Dr. Ramachandran says you take a speck of brain the size of a grain of sand. You got 100,000 neurons and 2 million axons and 1 billion synapses. But what's even more amazing that your brain uses up about 2% of your body weight. Okay, so if I weigh 200 pounds, my brain weighs between 3 or 4 pounds. That 2% uses up 20% of my energy. 20%. It also uses up 20% of my air, 25% of my blood, 30% of my water, 40% of my nutrients all go to that one little 2% of the brain. In fact, my brain uses up more energy than my heaviest muscle back here. If I could somehow screw a 40-watt light bulb, which is the bulb that kept the old refrigerators on, in your ear, the energy coming out of your brain would keep that light bulb on 24/7. It's amazing. Now, let's take this farther, okay? How many patterns can your brain carry? Read this with me out loud. We'll start at the very, very top. We'll do out loud. You have to be out loud. I'll help you. Here we go. The phenomenal power of the human mind. Can you read this? I couldn't believe that I could actually understand what I was reading. According to research at Cambridge University, it doesn't matter in what order the letters of a word are. The only important thing is that the first and last letter be in the right place. The rest can be a total mess, and you can still read it without a problem. This is because the human mind does not read every letter by itself, but the word as a pattern. Amazing, huh? Yeah, and I always thought spelling was important. Give yourself a hand. Now, let's go deeper. There are four misspelled words in that paragraph. Two of them are on the bottom line. What are they? Always is all right. Thought, no G. What's the other one? Important. Go up four lines. There's two on four lines up. Problem and because. Hello. That amazing? Okay. Read that. This message serves to prove how our mind can do amazing things. In the beginning it was hard, but now your mind is reading this line automatically without even thinking about it. So why did I drive down here from Rohnert Park all in one slide? My dear friends, and I'm saying this from the heart now, and I get teary-eyed when I share this because it's so exciting. The primary element that's holding us back from learning and growing and changing is what we say to ourselves. The primary element is not how old you are. It's not your background. It's not what happened to you. It's not how smart or dumb. It's what you are saying to yourself about yourself. Now, you can change what you're saying to yourself about yourself when? Right now. And what does your brain say? Okay. Is it true? Don't care. Isn't that exciting? Holy cow. Wow. Should we go deeper? Okay, let's go deeper. Okay. Even though this is true, the brain takes shortcuts. What does that say? Burn the bush. Does not say a bird in the bush. That does. To does. Okay. And yet you said, oh, I know this. This is so easy. There you go. Don't accept the brain is wrong. Listen, this is from the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Martin E.P. Seligman, author of Learned Optimism. Your brain is wrong a lot when you talk about yourself. I'm so stupid for doing that. When you say that, what does your brain say? Okay. Why? Because you said it. Is it true? Don't care. Do you know what we're going to learn? How to switch those messages today. So you're going to walk out of here saying, oh, no more. You're going to be walking out here at the healthy skeptic. When some of the stuff that you've been saying to yourself comes up, you're going to just say, wait a minute. I don't think so. And you know what your brain says? Okay. Fine with me. Wow. Wow. Is the cat going up the stairs or down the stairs? Not quite sure. Can you see the white dots or the black dots or the white dots or the black dots? Can't make up your mind? Not sure? Okay. I showed this to Mary. And it was really shocking because she called me a liar. I told her that the A and the B were the same color. And she said, you're crazy. The A is darker. The B is lighter. And I said, no, they're the same color. She said, prove it. So I said, okay. So can you see the bar? Same color, same color, same color, same color. And yet watch this. When I go back, what's obviously dark, what's obviously light? A is dark. B is light. What does the B have the A doesn't have? Shadow. Right. Shadow. So somehow the brain makes the B lighter so you can see it. But it's the same color. In other words, the brain has been fooling you your entire life. Hello, do you think you're alone? No, you're not. It's a human condition. We're going to catch him at his trade today. Okay, read this. How many letter Fs are in that? There's one. How many letter Fs do you see in that paragraph? Keep it to yourself. Don't say it out loud. I'll give you the answer. The answer is 7. You skipped over the uhs. You skipped over the uhs. Because the uhs don't have an S sound, they got a V sound. And you were taught to read phonetically. So the brain just blanked out the uhs. There they are. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It has nothing to do with how smart you are. It's the way your brain works. It's what your brain does. That's why this is so exciting, because we didn't know that 50 years ago. And that's why my mission in life is to share this with as many people as possible, because it is so exciting to discover this stuff together. Okay? So let's go back. This is our first daughter. Her name was Abby. And she was our first little baby, and we brought her home from the hospital. And she was, of course, the most perfect, beautiful, gorgeous, wonderful little baby. She was more beautiful than your baby was, okay? I mean, it was obvious. Mary's mother drove out from Michigan, or flew out from Michigan, to see her first granddaughter. And I was working in a hospital at the time, so I was at work. And Mary called me at the hospital, and she has never done that. And she was hysterical. She was crying. And she was with my mother, and my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law is a very sweet, gentle person, so I couldn't understand what's happening. Finally, I just drove home. I walked into her room, the living room, and there was Mary's mother patting Mary on the shoulder, and Mary was crying. And I sat down and said, what in the world happened? And Mary's mother looked up at me with little tears in her eyes. And she said, Steve, Abby's eyes are crossed. No, they're not. Yes, they are. No, they're not. Yes, they are. No, they're not. Back and forth, forth and back. Finally, we took her to a doctor after a couple of weeks or couple of days. What did the doctor say? Both of them were severely. She had strabismus on the right, amblyopia on the left. She had to have a series of surgeries. She had to have her eyes patched for a number of years to get them to work together. Even now, they don't work completely. Now, I'm really smart, okay? And my wife is smarter than I am. We got degrees up the wing-wang. Why didn't we see the crossed eyes? Didn't expect to more than that. Why didn't we see them? She's perfect. How could our perfect child have crossed eyes? Can't be done. Can you see what we do to each other, to ourselves? And we all do that. We're not alone. We all do that. Okay? In fact, this is the way she looks today. Isn't she pretty? And she just had her first son. So, in fact, I just drove over, just came back from taking care of her son with her. That's so exciting. Okay, so here's a principle. People behave and act not according to the truth, but the truth as they perceive it to be. One of my favorite stories is Cliff Young. Cliff Young entered the first Australian marathon, 1983. He was 62. And those are not Nikes. Those are called Australian muck boots right there. And he was completely toothless, and his coach was his 89-year-old mother. It was a 885-kilometer race, 545 miles, okay, five-day race. And 150 of the top runners in the world flew out to Australia for this first race. And Cliff Young showed up, and all the reporters ganged up on Cliff. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? And he said, well, I spent my life in the outback with my 2,000 acre farm, chasing my 2,000 head of sheep. This is a five-day race. I've run sheep for 3. So I thought this would really be fun. That's the word he used, okay? Well, with this kind of story, what do you think happened? He won, of course. I'm not going to tell you a story if he didn't win. Of course he won. But listen to this. Listen to this. He beat them all. by a day and a half. What did he do? Well, when you run a race like this, you run for 18 hours and you sleep for six. Cliff didn't know that. He didn't know you were supposed to sleep. So while all the other races were sleeping, he just kept on running, okay? Now, back to my important spot. Here we go. Everyone looking? That's really inspirational. I didn't drive down here to inspire you. Because you know and I know that inspiration lasts for maybe 3 days. And then we go back to the old ways. I'm here to help you change the way you think. So let me tell you what happened the next year. Next year, he had the same race. Cliff Young showed up, couldn't finish it because he injured himself. Eight runners beat his record. And the year after that, the year after that, they interviewed the runners. How could you run without sleeping? They said, easy, we looked at Cliff Young. If Cliff Young can do it, I can do it. And what did their brain say? Okay. Isn't that exciting? It all comes from here. And we know this now. Wow. Wow. Read the word. Keep it to yourself. Read the word. Look at the white, not the black. Don't look at the black. Look at the white. See this little guy running around during Christmas? See it? Okay, I'll make it easier for you. There he is. See it? Okay, everyone, what is it? Elf. See the word elf? Okay. E-L-F. There's the word right there. Okay? Okay, I just taught you to read white on black. Now watch this. When you see this word, call it out. One, two, three, what's this word? How long did it take you to see it? Flash of a second. Isn't that exciting? Doesn't take years and years of therapy. Wow. It's saying, no, I'm thinking differently. I'm going to say different things to myself. And what does my brain say? Okay. Is it true? I don't even care. But here's the important part. When you keep saying it, and we'll talk about this next, my job, and your brain is talking now, my job is to make it true in your life. Okay, there's really 15 principles in my book, and I brought a bunch with me for $20, and I'll pay for the tax. Okay, but we're only talking about two today because we only have time for two, and they're the most important. Number one, the brain believes you tell it. Number two, the brain locks on to what you lock on to. Okay, that's another thing that the brain does, and there's all sorts of stories, but we don't have time to get into the details. So it has what is called the reticular activating system. That's the physiological part of it, the RAS. It starts here in the basal ganglia and goes all over the place, okay? Has a number of jobs. The job we want to talk about now is that it locks on to what you deem as important, okay? So the best way story I can tell you is when I was a little boy, my dad taught me how to ride a bicycle. And he took me out to this road and took the training wheels off, and he put me on the bike, and he said, okay, now, son, Before I give you a shove, and don't worry, I'm going to run next to you. You see that rock in the road out there about 50 feet? Yes, Daddy. Don't run into that rock. And what happened? Bam, right into the rock. That's the way your brain works. That is the reason that worrying is simply nothing but negative goal setting. That's all it is. It's things that you're coming up with. A study from Stanford indicated that about 85% of the things we were worried about never happened. And that remaining 15%, the study went on to say 79% of the people said what happened was even better and it taught me some stuff that I need to really learn. That means 97% of all the stuff that you're worrying about is caca. Isn't that amazing? Hello. Wow. Okay. Or how many moms here? Moms here. Okay. Studies show you can have a brand new mother. They don't have too much money, so they live right next to the airport. And you got trucks and the planes roaring overhead. And once the baby goes to sleep, the mom can sleep right through the night without a problem. with the trucks and the planes. However, moms, and you know what's coming, if the baby begins to breathe differently, what happens, mom? Whew, you're up. And the dad, too. Well, that's not completely true. The dad usually sleeps if the mom's there. If the mom's gone, like visiting her, then the dad wakes up just as quickly. So he's just as connected, okay? But the mom immediately wakes up, not because of the jets and the trucks, because of the value that she placed on this precious little boy and girl. That's how your brain works. Wow. Or if I have to dial 411 to get someone number, is that still being available? I don't even know. It's not even there available anymore? Well, let's pretend it does. We used to dial 411, we get them. Okay, so you dial 411, and you get a recording. And the number is 707-584-8453. Click, okay, good. 707, Mary would walk in. No, you talk to me. No, oh gosh, I don't want to have to call them back. I remember 707. I remember 584-845. What did I say? Three, click. Oh, please answer. Please answer. As soon as somebody answers, what happens is 707-584-8453. Gone. Because the brain says don't need it. Amazing. The brain keeps what you lock onto. Okay? So who decides what's important? Who do you think decides what's important? Who? You do. Not your husband, not your wife. You do. Lock onto the black dot. Can you see the shade around the black dot? Okay, lock onto the black dot. Watch what happens to the shade. What's it doing? Fading away. That's what your brain does. You lock onto what you want, and the brain says the rest of the stuff isn't important. I will find a way to do it. So let's go back to Abby, okay? This is 17 years later, and Abby's a senior in high school. Actually, she's a junior in high school. She hates going to class. She thinks it's stupid. She loves the social part. Both of my daughters are redheads, flaming redheads, and they're both, well, Abby more than Sarah, is a drama queen. And so I took her out to Old Sac to talk about what she's going to do when she graduated, which college. She said, Daddy, I never want to go to college. I think that's stupid. I just want to go to Hollywood to be an actress. Oh, that's scary. But we know Abby, and we know that was her heart, and we know that's what she wanted. And we prayed about it an awful lot. And finally, when the time came, we said, okay, and packed up a truck and moved it down to Hollywood, and Mary cried all the way home, and I prayed all the way home, and Mary and Abby lived there for 7 years. She eventually ended up writing or working for Spelman Industries. Remember Spelling? 90210, Charlie's Angels. Yes. And she worked for the writers of Charmed. Have you ever heard of Charmed? Stupid thing. But it's still in syndication. Yeah. And it's about witches and warlocks and stuff like this. If you've ever seen it, it's the most inane thing you've ever seen. But these writers came from Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. And Abby called me. She said, Daddy, they come in. They've got the Wall Street Journal. They're talking about all this stuff. I have no idea what they're talking about. All I do is get them coffee and donuts and make copies of the scripts. If I don't get a college education, that's what's going to happen to me. And we said, And then she said, would you mind if I stay down here in L.A. for another year and went to the J.C.? Okay. And she did. And then she called. She said, would you mind if I live with you and mom and went to the J.C. up in Santa Rosa? And we said, yep, okay. So we rented another truck and drove her back to our house and repainted her room. And we learned that if the door was shut, you had to not only knock on the door, but you had to walk by the door very quietly because she was studying. And she'd get really upset if there was any noise at all. And she eventually graduated summa cum laude from UC Berkeley. There she is. Wow. Now, what happened? She locked onto what she wanted, and the brain found a way. One of the biggest nightmares of UC Berkeley is student housing. And she found a lawyer who had a practice in New York, who had a Tudor mansion up in the Berkeley Hills, who every year would pick a student to live in her Tudor mansion free of charge if they took care of her dog. So her last year in Berkeley, we took care of the dog on weekends, but that's another whole story. But her last year in Berkeley was living in a Tudor mansion. The brain finds a way, my friends. The brain's amazing, absolutely amazing. So why does our mind have to do this? Well, you've got the conscious. We won't talk about that too much. You have the subconscious. What I want to give you another principle that's really important to understand, and that's this, that we have a self-image, but that's not completely true. We don't have one self-image. We have millions of self-images. I've never seen a study that estimates how many self-images we have, but we have lots. We have a self-image for every single thing that we do, every relationship, every habit, every attitude, every ability. We have all these self-images. You have a self-image for every meal that you cook. I cook really good scrambled eggs. My secret is I use a lot of butter. My poached eggs are horrible. They're yucky because I don't like poached eggs. So I have a really high self-image for my scrambled and a low one for my poached, okay? What's the point? The point is this. If I have two self-images for just two meals that I cook, you can imagine how many thousand self-images I must have. So I have all these thousand self-images, and these self-images are in your subconscious. You don't have to remember that you're shy at party. You just are, okay? So they're on your subconscious. Now, there's a third element, which are called different things, but I like to call it the creative subconscious. It has a number of jobs. We'll only talk about one. The creative subconscious' main job is to make sure that what I do lines up with those self-images. Okay? It's called maintaining sanity. And the principle is that your mind will not let you be unlike yourself. So let's go back to, I ended up teaching math at the University of San Francisco. And first day of class, around the third semester or so, Susie came to my office, sat down in my office. She was very, very shy. And she said, "Mr. Campbell, I'm so glad you're my math professor, but I'm a C student in math. I always have been, always will be, so don't feel bad when you give me a C." And I said, "Well, I used to be that way. I used to be that way, so let's work together." So I worked with her, got some tutors with her, and she really worked hard, and she got an A in the first midterm. I was so excited. "Can I borrow a piece of paper?" "Okay. I'll do this one." Okay, so imagine this is the test. So I gave her the test, and she freaked out. And then she looked at me, and she said, "Oh, Mr. Campbell, this is a mistake." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "I've never gotten above a C on a math test. You must have made a mistake." And I said, "I didn't. I grade this myself. This is an A, Susie." So then she looked at it longer, and then a big smile creased over her face. And she looked at me, and she said, "Do you know what this means?" And I'm getting really excited. I said, "No, of course I do, but you tell me. She said, "This means that when I flunk the next test, I can still maintain my C." I said, "Susie, just get an A in every test." She said, "I can't." "Why?" What was her answer? "Because I'm a C student." "I'm a C student," and that's exactly what happened. She flunked the next test. She got a C in the course. Now, I sat down with her with the A, and I said, "Susie, answer me this. What would have happened if you had flunked this test?" Do you know what she said without a moment's hesitation? You already know. What did she say? "I'd have to get an A on the next test to maintain my C." "Just get an A in every test." She said, "I can't." "Why?" "Because I'm a C student. I've always been this way. I can't really change. This is the way it is. I'm too old. I'm too young. I can't make that change. I can't make that money. I can't make that move. I can't repair that relationship." And on and on and on and on and on. Or, hang on to your seats. Do you know when your old life ended? About 1 second ago. Do you know when your new life began? About 1 second ago. Now do the math. If you have 60 seconds per minute, and then 60 minutes per hour, and 24 hours per day, that means that in one 24-hour period, you have 86,400 new opportunities for a new life. Every single day. And what does your brain say? Okay. Is it true? Yes. It is true. That I know. Has anyone worked under a trained hypnotist, been under a trained hypnotist? Okay, this has been, this study has been repeated over and over and over, but I just want to begin to share that. We're beginning to close here. What a trained hypnotist is, they give you a temporary suggestion right here in your subconscious. So I'm going to go back to your husband. I'm assuming this is your husband. Okay, good. What's your name?
Roger.
Roger, okay. It looks as if you are not a weightlifter, Roger. I think that's a pretty safe. Okay, the reason I'm asking is because I'm going to hypnotize you. I'm not going to, but I hypnotize you and I say that this mouse weighs 500 pounds. You don't look as if you could lift 500 pounds. Okay? Okay. So, Roger cannot lift 500 pounds. I can't either, which means one of the trillions of self-images he has is I cannot lift 500 pounds. It's in there wired someplace, way in the back, but it's there. Okay? Okay. So I hypnotize them and I say, this weighs 500 pounds. I'll give you $1,000 if you pick it up. So Roger really wants the 1,000 bucks. So he reaches over and grabs the mouse and tries to pick it up, and the mouse doesn't budge. Now he's under hypnosis now, thinking that this weighs 500 pounds. It doesn't budge. It doesn't move, and he's really trying because I can see the perspiration begin to show on his forehead. He's really trying to pick it up, and it doesn't budge. Now, I don't know Roger completely, so I don't completely trust him. So I'm going to attach an electrode to his biceps, the muscles that reach up, and I attach the other end to some sort of a medical measuring device. It shows that Roger is picking up with about 40 pounds worth of force, and the mouse only weighs a few ounces, which would bounce right off the table. The mouse still doesn't move, doesn't touch, and he's lifting with enough force. Why do you think the mouse isn't moving? Any ideas? Why is the mouse not moving? He doesn't think he can do it, but what's the brain doing? Okay, remember this forever. I'm sorry? Yes, remember this forever. Thank you. If I attach electrodes to his triceps, the muscles that push down, do you know what it's going to show? It's going to show that while he's lifting with 40 pounds for the $1,000, he's pushing down with 40 pounds for sanity. Because his brain says, I cannot do this. Now, here's the exciting part. When you say, I can't, the brain says, okay. But when you say, I can, what does the brain say to that? Okay, and it becomes obsessed with finding ways to do it. It starts with the way you think. Wow. And then the brain rewires itself, and this is called neuroplasticity, and here's the books. This is relatively new, The Brain That Changes Itself, and Eric Kendall, etc. Okay. When I wrote my book, the original title is Making Your Mind Your Mentor. They changed it to Making Your Mind Magnificent. I like my title better because a mentor is someone who sees more in you than you see in yourself. And that's what your brain can become. Okay? All right, let's begin to close now. If I stopped here, well, first of all, let me share this with you. If I stopped here and said, thank you so much, I'm so glad that you had me here, this has really been fun, you would say, this guy was really good, and you come back next week, you should have heard him, he talked about the brain, he was funny and handsome and good-looking and all this sort of stuff. What did he say? I have no idea, but it's really good. Something about the brain, okay? The reason is because all this information I just gave you is on the left side of your brain. It's being processed, okay? But there's an old adage, if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's really true. If you don't use this, you're going to lose it, okay? So what I want to do for the last few minutes, and then we'll close, is I want to take this information and get it over here where you are, your feelings, your intuitions, the person that you really are. Again, we are not thinking as people who feel. We're feeling people who think. So for the last few minutes, we're going to give you just two ways of thinking. What I call two new ways of thinking, and this will help you use this as you're walking out the door for the rest of your life. It's really easy. Three are too many, so we'll just stay down to two, okay? Okay. First one is a study out of Stanford University in 1975 called the Effort Effect, and what they discovered is that most of us pass over our successes too quickly, too lightly for them to ever become a part of our self-image. So when someone says, good job, do you know what we say? Oh, not really. Oh, that's embarrassing. That's egotistical. I mean, I was part of a team. Thank you very much. I'll do better next time. But I could have done. Oh, well, no, that makes me. No, really. Oh, no, 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 no. Well, what have we learned today? When you say no, 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 what does your brain say? Okay. It is not only sad, but what a waste. Okay, so here's your new way of thinking. Ready? When someone says, good job, you look at them and you smile and you say, thanks, I know. Now, I was down in Huntington Beach doing an all-day seminar. By the way, I'm doing an all-day seminar in Foster City in October, and I've got some flyers there. If you're interested in that, they'll be back there. I was doing an all-day seminar in Huntington Beach for 150 Kaiser physicians. And when I said, thanks, I know, the whole audience just broke up and laughed just like you. But it really surprised me. But they loved me. They loved me. They just loved me. They bought my book. They signed up for my all-day seminar. One guy, actually, one doctor, left me a voicemail. I'm flying my whole family up there, which he did, and he's continually doing it. They just thought it was the best thing in the world. And when I was driving back to the airport, I almost drove off the freeway. I was so excited about what happened. So I stopped by a Chevron, got a tuna sandwich and a Coke, and I was alone in my car, and I looked in the passenger mirror, because I'm nearsighted, so I had to take my glasses off. I looked at myself in the passenger mirror, and nobody else saw me do this. And I said to myself, I said, oh, you are an amazing speaker. And what did my brain say? Okay, you really are. But again, this is from Dr. Seligman. You know what it also said? And don't miss this. This is so excited. I get so, you know what else it said? It said, and you could even be better. Oh, it opened up the gate. And I began thinking of all sorts of ways that I could be a better teacher. I'll do this and change that and this and that and this. Now, if I had said, you know what, you messed up here, you messed up there, you messed up here, which I did, what would have happened to the gate, everyone? Slam shut. Okay? Okay, so let's make this doable. Can you start using this as you're walking out the door? Number one. When someone says, good job, you look at them and smile and you say, you know, that makes me feel really nice. Thank you for taking the time to tell me that. And then when you get by yourself, you wallow in your success like a pig in slop. Okay? I mean, you wallow in it because, my dear friends, no one else is going to but you. And who in the world said you can't do that? No one that I know of. So wallow in it. Wow. Okay. Best for last. Throw away the list. What's the list? The list is when you make those big bonehead mistakes. And you say, oh my gosh, how could I have been so stupid? When you ask that question, the brain immediately says, oh, I know. Remember that dumb thing you did yesterday and that dumb thing you did a week ago, a month ago, a year ago? Remember how you were the slowest reader in the third grade? And we get out this list, and we start going down the list of all the dumb things we've ever done. Now, this is really important to understand. When you do this, when you go down the list and memorize and remember all the stupid things that you've done, your brain does not know that those memories happened a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. It is recording them again. But this time, as if they happened when? Now. And then you're carrying that stuff around. Okay, I've got some great news, and I get teary-eyed. Mary's not here, so I can do that, and she won't get pissed off. You don't have to do that anymore. Starting when? Now. Okay, Steve, that sounds great. What do you do? What do you do instead? Number one, throw away the list. Okay? The list is good if you're a kid, but you don't need the list anymore. So learn from your mistakes, throw away the list. Number two, use three wonderful words. You know what the words are? The words are the next time. The next time I'll do it this way. The next time I'll do it that way. Well, when you say the next time, you're saying three things. Number one, you're saying there is a next time. How many next times do we get? As many as we want, millions and billions and trillions and trillions. We have as many next times as you want. Isn't that great? Number two, when you say the next time, what you're really saying is, I'll never give up, ever. It's not part of my vocabulary. And number three, best for last, when you say the next time, what you're really saying is, I'm still learning, I'm still growing, I'm still changing, which means I'm still making mistakes. But just because I fail does not mean I'm a failure. Thomas Edison was asked how it felt to fail 999 times looking for the filament of a light bulb. He said, I did not fail 999 times. I simply found 999 ways it didn't work. Isn't that great? And it's all a process. When our first little girl took her first walk, she fell on the carpet, looked up at us, and she says, well, Dad, I guess I was never meant for walking. She got up, she took two steps, and then she fell. Three steps, and then she fell. She's 42. Is she still falling? Yes. How do I know? Because she's still walking. You don't fall unless you walk. One last story, and then we'll close. I was on my way to work one morning. I was waiting for the light to change, and a kid came up to you on those one of those big used SUVs, and I knew what was going to happen. The light changed. He went peeling out in front of me, roaring up 101. And passing everyone on the freeway. And I watched this whole, I had this epiphany while I was watching him pass everyone. The epiphany was, how many cars are already in front of him? Millions, okay? How many cars are behind him? Millions, yeah. So maybe it's not a matter of how fast you get there. Maybe it's a matter of you're going in the right direction. But even when you're going in the right direction, sometimes you just run out of gas. Or you get a flat tire. Or sometimes you even lose your way. But you know what? You can buy some more gas. You can replace the tire. You can get a map. And what's so wonderful about the brain is the brain just says what? Okay. Is it true? Don't care. All I care about is what you tell me. You say it, I believe it. You lock onto it, you know what I will do? I will do everything I can to make it true in your life. Wow. I told you to be quiet. Questions?
All right. I'll just be a second. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. And you are listening to Stephen R. Campbell, author of Making Your Mind Magnificent. And by the way, Stephen does have books in the back. So will you sign?
Yeah.
If people? Wonderful. Good. All right. So I know we have questions. Candice, would you please pass the mic?
Wonderful presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have two wonderful grandchildren, actually four. I lost count there.
Mine are.
No. Could you give us suggestions on how we could language your insights for children age 0
just
to 10?
Just encourage them. When they make mistakes, just encourage them. There's so many things that we could get in for children that we just don't have time to talk about here. Just when they make their mistakes, I'm sorry.
When they make the mistakes, point it out to them. You got to be realistic, but don't try to get into you're stupid because of that. Get away from that. Just you make mistakes, welcome to the world, hon. Yeah. The reason I love this is because I had to tell myself this for years and years and years before I began believing it. Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing, though. Yes. Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry.
Where is the mind?
Pardon me?
Where is the mind?
Oh, that's a philosophical question that we could spend days that I don't want to take the time to do it.
25 words or less answered.
It's up here.
Well,
there's a lot of different ones. There's one in the heart. There's one in the tummy. There's one. They're discovering different nervous systems. They're also called the minds, but I'd like to think it up there. It's centered. Yeah. 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 They're discovering. That's not what you're looking for. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. We'll use something else. Yes.
Thanks again. This is wonderful.
Thank you.
Quick question for you. If your brain locks on to what you tell it to lock on to, then who's the you? And this may actually go to his question as well, but what's telling the brain?
Okay, there's a slide that I have that I didn't have time to show you that basically you've got a conversation going on between your right and your left. The rights are the feelings, the real you. The left is the logical part, okay? And they're talking to each other, and they can fight with each other. They can disagree with each other, okay? So there's a conversation going on. Now, when you get what you seem to be saying is sometimes you get stuck in some messages that you're giving yourself. Is that? No? Yeah. We didn't have time to talk about this, but what I talk about in my book is the fact that you have these self-images, and we didn't talk about this, but your self-images are based solely on your self-talk. They're based on what you say to yourself about yourself, okay? There's a number of things with that. Number one, you cannot get rid of your self-images. You can't get rid of them. They're hardwired in your brain, okay? Number two, they're really hard to change because they're based on your self-talk, and most of what you say to yourself, research shows, is bad stuff. It's negative stuff. So what we do, and I teach this, we don't have time to talk about it today, is you, rather than try to change your self-image, you simply create brand new ones that override the old ones. So when people say, I'm trying to break a habit, I say, why try to break the habit? Just create a new one that override the old one. We put all this energy into trying to break a habit? No, no, no. Mary smoked for the first 10 years of our marriage, and she would say every January 1st, this is the year, this is the year, this is the year, and it would work, and then it wouldn't. The reason she couldn't quit smoking is because she never changed how she saw herself up here. She saw herself as a smoker who was not smoking, and the brain said, wait a minute, if you're a smoker, you got to smoke. Then one summer, she went home to watch her father die of lung cancer, and I picked her up at SFO. She said, you are looking at a non-smoker, because that's how I see myself now. And what my book shows is how to create new self-images without having to watch your father die of lung cancer. Makes sense? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Could you explain what the connection is? Let me rephrase.
Sure.
Is this sort of the same as the mind-body connection when they talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
it's called different things.
Yes.
Yes.
So when you're doing this, I mean, people say, for example, when people have serious illnesses, and they say you have to have a positive thought.
Yeah, there's a whole section in optimism and stuff like that. Yes.
So, I mean, does that really work?
Oh, yes. To a point, the mind, I'm not going to say this an end all and be all. The mind's the mind is realistic, okay? But studies have shown, and I've shown in other studies in my book, that people who are optimistic about strokes and stillness, they just recover faster. They just do. They just do. Yeah. Yes.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering what if we tell ourselves something that we don't quite believe in? Does that count still?
Like what?
Like, for example, one minute you're like, yeah, I'm going to be really good at math. And then the second is like, not really. Yeah, no, I'm really going to be good at it. And then
it's a battle. Uh-huh. It's a battle. Let me share with you a story of my sister, Sally. Sally is 5'2", and she has always struggled with weight. And so when I wrote my book, she literally got the first chapters. And as a result of that, she lost 60 pounds as a result. She said lots of the books, but I think she did it, so my book, anyway. She wrote her first affirmation, and her first affirmation was, I'm going to weigh 120 and look great and da-da-da. And she called me about a month after. She said, the problem is, Steve, I can never see myself at 120. And I didn't want to say this, but I was going to say, I can't either, Sally. But I said, can you, and she was 192 when this whole thing started. I said, can you see yourself at 185? She said, yes, start with that. Oh, okay, that's realistic. Our brain isn't stupid. It's got to be realistic, okay? So it's what I call the realistic test. If it's not realistic, the brain's going to say, forget it, okay? That was realistic. So she got down 185. She called me back, stand there. Okay, so let's go another 5 pounds. She said, no, let's go another 15. And she got down to 160, and she called me. She said, I look great. This is where I want to be. So it's got to be realistic. Their brain's not stupid. Yeah, yeah.
I'm a retired math teacher.
Yay!
In the public schools of San Francisco, and I retired in 1991. I've been reading and thinking and reading and thinking, how can we get all of this kind of wonderful stuff into education?
Yeah, Yeah. I do seminars, or I do work. I go into classrooms and I give this to classrooms, usually fifth grade and above. At the super top. Yeah. I know. It's my goal is to get in as many schools as I can. And I know. That's why I want to share this with everyone. In fact, if you'd like me to come to speak to your organization, please give me your business card, because and my fee is zero to nothing. Don't tell Mary. That makes her really pissed off. But it's just this. I'm not. Anyway, yes.
Thank you, Steve. That's great. My name's Steve Keenan. My mentor is having issues with dementia,
yeah.
Alzheimer's. Some thoughts on that, please. And do the coconut oil with the ketones, is this a real cure?
Yeah. Thank you. I am not a physician, so I really am not comfortable, and neither am I a psychologist, but I can give you a couple of stories that might help. I have given this presentation to retirement facilities all over California, and I'll never forget this when this one woman came in to the first session. And she was crying, obviously. So afterwards, I introduced her, sat down. My name is Steve. I'm glad you're here. I noticed that you were upset. She said, yes, I just came from the doctor's office. I've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And I took care of my mother. I know it's coming. And I'm scared to death. And I don't know what to do with it. And I said, well, come to my 8-hour seminar. And I'm not going to be able to cure the Alzheimer's. But I'm going to help you think about it differently than the way you think about it now. And I saw her, and she went through the whole thing, and I saw her 6 months later, came back to do a follow-up, and how you doing? I'm doing great, Steve. And I'm seeing this happen, but my attitude is so different than what it was before. I'm not a physician, so I'm not comfortable with saying anything more than that. What I help people is to encourage them, that when they say, I'm stuck this way, the brain says, yeah, you are. But you can also say, wait a minute. Let's think this way. The brain says, yeah, you're right, absolutely. Okay.
Stephen, our time is gone.
Okay.
But will you answer questions as you sign books?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's close up. Our thanks to Stephen R. Campbell, author of Making Your Mind Magnificent, for his comments today. We also thank the audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.